toward them across the stone floor. "I've been looking all over," she said. "Where is she?"
"I sent Alyssa down to my office before the clothes came off," Pam said.
"Hi, Mrs. Pilcher. You look lovely tonight."
"Thank you. I was sorry to hear you won't be joining us."
Elizabeth stared at her husband.
"When are you going under?"
"Soon."
"I don't want to stay here tonight. You'll have someone drive Alyssa and me back to Boise?"
"Of course. Whatever you want. And you can take the jet."
"Well, I guess it's probably time to..."
"Right. Why don't you head on down to my office? I'll join you in a minute. I just need to see about one last thing." Pilcher watched his wife walk back across the cavern toward the level one entrance. He wiped his face, said, "I should not be shedding tears tonight. At least not these kind."
Elizabeth stepped off the elevator. Their suite was silent. She had never liked it, never liked anything about life inside this mountain. All claustrophobia, a sense of isolation she had never come to terms with. Her soul felt hunched over from the sheer, crushing weight of living with this driven, single-purposed man. But tonight, finally, she and her daughter would be free. The doors to David's office were open. She walked in.
"Alyssa? Honey?"
No answer. She crossed to the monitors. It was late. Her daughter had probably curled up on one of the couches for a nap. She reached them. No. Empty. She made a slow scan of the room. Maybe Alyssa had wandered back upstairs? They could have missed each other, although that seemed unlikely. Her eyes caught on David's desk. He always kept it immaculate, free of clutter, free of anything at all, but now a single sheet of white paper lay in the center. Nothing else. She walked over, pulled the page toward her across the polished mahogany so she could read it. "Dear Elizabeth, Alyssa is coming with me. You can see the end of your story on your own. What's left of it? David." Elizabeth had a sudden strong sense of a presence behind her. Turned. Arnold Pope stood just within reach. He'd shaved for the celebration. Tall, broad-shouldered. Short blonde hair and almost handsome. It was his eyes that killed the deal. Something in them, a touch too cruel and dispassionate when they held your focus. She could smell the champagne on his breath. She said,
"No."
"I'm sorry, Elizabeth."
"Please?"
"I like you. Always have. I will make this go as fast as possible. But you have to work with me."
She looked down at his hands, half expecting to see a knife or a wire, but they were empty. She felt weak and sick.
"Can't I just have a moment, please? Please?"
She met his eyes. They were cold, intense, and sad, revving up for something. And she knew, a half second before he came at her, that she wasn't going to get that moment. Part 4, Chapter 22. Tobias warmed his grimy hands in the heat of the fire. He was camped riverside, deep in the mountains of what had once been Idaho. From where he sat, he could stare down the canyon and watch the sun falling into the V. So close. Earlier in the day, he'd caught a glimpse of the jagged cirque that formed the amphitheater on Wayward Pine's eastern wall. The only thing stopping him from reaching the fence was a thousand-strong swarm of abbeys in the forest that bordered the southern edge of town. Even 2 miles away from their position, he could smell them. Assuming they moved on overnight, he'd be in the clear to go home. The temptation to sleep on the ground was strong. Something about sleeping on the soft pine needles seemed massively appealing. But that would be stupid. He'd already fixed his bivy 30 feet up in one of the overhanging pine trees. He'd slept off the ground, he didn't know how many nights running. One more wouldn't kill him. And tomorrow night, if all went as planned and he didn't get himself eaten his last day in the wilderness, he'd have a warm bed to crawl into. Tobias opened his rucksack, shoved his arm to the bottom. His fingers touched the cloth bag containing his pipe, a book of matches from the Hotel Andra in Seattle, and the tobacco. He laid everything out on a rock. It was strange. He'd thought about this moment so many times, built it up in his mind, his last night in the wilderness. He'd brought a pound with him, all the weight he could justify, and burned right through it in those first months, saving only enough tobacco for one last smoke if he made it this far. There were so many nights when he'd almost smoked it anyway. The rationalizations, plentiful and compelling. You could die at any time. You'll never make it back. Don't get eaten still holding on to what could have been a half hour of pipe joy. And still, he held out. It made no sense. His chances of returning were nil. But as he opened the plastic baggie and breathed in the smell of the aromatic blend, it was unquestionably one of the happiest moments of his life. He took his time filling the bowl, then tamped it down with his finger, making sure each sprig was lovingly nestled. The tobacco took the flame beautifully. He dragged on the stem. God, the smell! Smoke clouding around his head. He leaned back against the trunk of what he hoped was the last tree he would ever have to sleep in. The sky had turned pink. You could see the color of it on the river. He smoked and watched the moving water and felt, for the first time in ages, like a human being. Chapter 23. At 8 p.m., Ethan was back behind his desk in the station. His phone rang. When he lifted the receiver, Pilcher said, "Dr. Mitre is more than a little angry with you, Ethan." The image of Pilcher climbing up on that autopsy table and stabbing his daughter surfaced in the back of Ethan's mind. "You monster." "Did you hear that?" Ethan asked.
"Hear what?"
For 5 seconds, Ethan was silent on the line. "That's the sound of me not giving a fuck."
"You are still unchipped, and I don't like it."
"Look, I didn't feel like going under the knife again so soon. I'll come up to the mountain tomorrow, first thing, and get it over with."
"You haven't run into Pam, have you?"
"No, why?"
"She was supposed to be in the mountain 30 minutes ago for a meeting. Her signal still shows her down in the valley."
After returning to town, Ethan had walked to Main Street and slipped Pam's bloody microchip into the purse of a woman he passed on the sidewalk. Sooner or later, Pilcher was going to start studying camera feeds. When Pam's chip pinged a camera but Pam herself was mysteriously absent, Pilcher would know something had happened.
"If I see her," Ethan said, "I'll tell her you're looking for her."
"I'm not too worried. She tends to go on walkabouts from time to time. At the moment, I'm sitting in my office with a bottle of very nice scotch, watching my wall of screens, ready for the show to begin. Do you have any questions?"
"No."
"You've looked over the manual. You understand the sequence of calls, the instructions you're about to give?"
"Yes."
"If Kate and Harold are killed in the forest, if they're killed anywhere other than Main Street, center of town, I'm going to hold you personally responsible. Keep in mind they have underground support, so give the first wave of officers a little extra time."
"I understand."
"Pam delivered the phone codes to your office earlier in the day. I've got them here on my desk beside the manual. But you can see that, can't you?" Pilcher just laughed. "I know your history with Kate Ballinger," he said, "and I'm sorry if that's going to put a shadow over tonight for you."
"A shadow?"
"But fates don't come along all that often. Sometimes a year or two passes between them. So in spite of everything, I hope you'll try to enjoy yourself. Much as I hate them, there's something truly magic in these nights."
In his previous life, Ethan had developed the bad habit of flipping off the phone
when he didn't like the person or the message on the other end of the line. He somehow, and wisely, found the strength to restrain himself. "Well, I'll let you go, Ethan. You've got lots to do. If you don't have too bad of a hangover in the morning, I'll send Marcus down to pick you up. We'll have breakfast. Talk about the future."
"Looking forward to it," Ethan said.
Belinda had gone home. The station was silent. It was 8:05 p.m. It was time. Hector Gaither's piano came through the tube radio beside the desk. He was playing the Rimsky-Korsakov edition of A Night on the Bear Mountain. The frantic and terrifying section had concluded, and he was entering the slow, calming down movement that conjured up the feeling of daybreak after a night in hell. Ethan's thoughts were with Kate and Harold. Were they sharing a quiet dinner at this very moment, with Gaither's piano in the background? Utterly blind to what was about to happen. Ethan picked up his phone and opened the folder Pam had left with Belinda. He looked at the first code and dialed. A female voice answered. "Hello?" There was a ping. The ringing continued. Each time someone answered, there was another ping. Finally, a voice that sounded computer-generated said, "All 11 parties are now on the line." Ethan stared down at the page. The script had been typed out for him beneath the code. He could still just hang up. Not do this. There were so many ways for it all to go so badly. None of the 10 residents of Wayward Pines on the other end of the line breathed a single word. Ethan began to read. "This message is for the 10 officers of the fate. A fate has been scheduled to begin in 40 minutes. The guests of honor are Kate and Harold Ballinger. Their address is 345 8th Avenue. Make your preparations immediately. Of critical importance is delivering Kate and Harold to the circle at the corner of 8th and Main alive and unharmed. Do you understand what I've just said to you?" A series of yeses tripped over one another, coming through the line. Ethan hung up the phone and started the timer on his watch. The officers lived for the fate. They were the only residents allowed to keep actual weapons in their homes, machetes issued by Pilcher. Everyone else resorted to makeshift instruments of death, kitchen knives, rocks, baseball bats, axes, hatchets, iron pokers from a fireplace set, anything with heft, a point, or an edge. He had wondered all afternoon what this block of time would feel like, the 40 minutes between setting everything in motion and making that final phone call. And now that he was in it, it screamed past with unimaginable velocity. He wondered if the last meal of a death row inmate felt something like this. Time moving at the speed of light, pulse rate accelerating, an eerie emotional review of all that had led to this moment. And then he was watching the last 10 seconds wind down on his watch, wondering where the time had gone. He silenced the alarm, lifted the phone, punched in the second code. The same computer-generated voice advised, "Please record your message after the tone." He waited. The tone came. He read off the second script. "This is Sheriff Ethan Burke. A fate begins now. The guests of honor are Kate and Harold Ballinger. They are to be caught, brought unharmed to Maine and 8th. He struggled with the final words, and executed in the circle. After a long pause, that CG voice said, "If you are satisfied with your message, press 1. To review your message prior to sending, press 2. To re-record your message, press 3. For all other options, press 4. Ethan pressed 1 and shelved the phone. He got up. On his desk, the nickel plating of the Desert Eagle gleamed under the lamp. He reloaded and holstered it, and walked over to the closet, where he took down the headdress and the bearskin cloak. 3 steps from the door, the ringing started. The first one bled through the radio. The piano playing stopped. He heard the bench squeak, Gaither standing. The man's footsteps trailing away. the sound of him lifting the phone, saying, "Hello?" Then Ethan's voice, the message he had just recorded, came quietly through the speakers. Gaither whispered, "Oh, God!" and then the radio transmission cut to static. Ethan moved down the hallway, thinking only of Kate. "Did your phone ring? Did you answer it and listen to my voice ordering your death? Do you think that I've betrayed you?" He passed Belinda's desk, made his way through the dark lobby. Outside there was no moon, just a sky chock full of stars. He'd heard this sound before, as his own fate was beginning, but tonight it seemed more sinister because he fully understood the implications. Hundreds and hundreds of telephones simultaneously ringing, an entire town receiving instructions to murder one of their own. For a moment, he just stood, listening with a kind of horrified wonder. The sound filled the valley like haunted church bells. Someone ran past on the street. Several blocks away, a woman screamed, though whether from excitement or pain, he couldn't tell. He walked down to the sidewalk and peered through the large glass windows of the Bronco. They were tinted, and considering the only light source was a street lamp across the road, it was impossible to see anything inside. Carefully, he opened the driver's side door. No noise, no movement. He tossed the cloak and headpiece into the passenger seat and climbed in behind the wheel. It was like driving through his old neighborhood in Seattle on Halloween night. People everywhere, on the sidewalks, in the streets, staggering around clutching open mason jars, torches, baseball bats, golf clubs. The costumes had been ready and waiting. He cruised past a man in an old bloodstained tuxedo, carrying a 2x4 carved down into a handle at one end, the other embedded with shards of metal like a mace. The houses had all gone dark. There were points of light appearing everywhere. Flashlights sweeping through bushes and alleyways, cones of light shining into trees. Even from behind the wheel, Ethan could see the divisions in the gathering crowd. How some people saw the fate as nothing more than a chance to dress up, get drunk, go a little crazy. How others carried an angry purpose in their visage, a clear intent to do harm, or at the very least, drink their fill of watching violence done. How some could barely stand it, tears running down their face as they moved toward the center of the madness. He kept to the side streets. Between 3rd and 4th, the headlights struck a pack of children 30 strong running across the road, bubbling with deadly laughter like hyenas, all costumed, knives gleaming in their little hands. He kept a lookout for the officers. They'd be dressed in black and wielding machetes, but he never saw them. Ethan turned onto 1st, headed south out of town. In the road beside the pastures, he stopped the Bronco, turned off the car, stepped outside. The phones had stopped ringing, but the noise of an assembling crowd was growing. It dawned on him that it was in this exact spot, 4 nights ago, that he'd discovered Alyssa Pilcher. God, how quickly it had all come to this. Wasn't quite time for him to make his appearance, but soon it would be. "Are you still running, Kate? Have they caught you? Are they dragging you and your husband toward Main Street? Are you afraid? Or on some level, have you been long prepared for this, ready for this nightmare to finally end?" On the outskirts of Wayward Pines, it was cold and dark. He felt strangely isolated, like standing outside a stadium and listening to the noise of a game. In town, something exploded. Glass bursting, people cheering. He waited 15 minutes, sitting on the hood of the Bronco with the warmth of the engine coming through the metal. Let them gather. Let them go mad. Nothing would be done without him. No blood would be spilled. When Pam opened her eyes, it was dark. She was shivering, her head throbbing. Left leg on fire like something had ripped a chunk out of it. She sat up. Where the fuck was she? It was freezing and dark, and the last thing she remembered was leaving the hospital after her final therapy session of the day. Wait, no. She spotted Ethan Burke's Bronco heading south out of town, followed him on foot. It all came back. They'd fought. She'd lost, apparently. What the hell had he done to her? When she stood, the pain in her leg made her cry out. She reached back. A large piece of her jeans had been cut away, and a nasty, open wound oozed down her left thigh. He'd cut out her microchip. That fucking motherfucker! The rage hit like a shot of morphine. She felt no pain, even when she started running away from the fence, back toward town, faster and faster through the dark forest, the electrified hum dwindling into silence. The sound of screams in the distance stopped her. Abby screams. Many, many Abby screams. But something wasn't right. How could there be screams coming from straight ahead? Wayward Pines lay straight ahead. In fact, she should have reached the road by... Shit. 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 She didn't know how long she'd been running, but she'd been running hard, running right through the pain. She'd come a mile at least from the fence. Not far ahead, in addition to the screams of what sounded like a massive Abbey swarm, she heard movement coming her way, limbs breaking, sticks snapping, and she could swear she even smelled them, an eye-watering carrion stench growing stronger by the second. In all of her years, she had never wanted to cause someone pain so badly. Ethan Burke hadn't just cut her microchip out. He'd somehow stranded her on the other side of the fence, out in the mean, wild world. Ethan climbed back into the Bronco, fired up the engine, floored the accelerator. Tires squealed on the pavement as he launched forward. He sped into the forest, took the big looping curve that brought him back on a trajectory toward town. The speedometer read 80 as he blasted past the welcome sign. He took his foot off the gas, let the RPMs die. On Main Street now, and still a quarter mile from his destination, but already he could see flames in the distance, the buildings all aglow with firelight and the kinetic shadows of the crowd. He passed the hospital. 4 blocks from the intersection of 8th and Main, he was steering around people in the road. Something had been thrown through the storefront glass of the Sweet Tooth, and kids were looting the candy. This was all acceptable and expected. The crowd became denser. An egg broke across the passenger side window, yolk running down the glass. He was barely moving now, people constantly in the way. Everyone costumed. He steered through a group of men dressed up in drag, lipstick garishly applied, wearing their wives' bras and panties over long johns, one of them armed with a cast-iron skillet. An entire family, including children, had ringed their eyes with dark eyeshadow and painted their faces white to resemble the Walking Dead. He saw devil's horns, vampire teeth, fright wigs, angel wings, top hats, sharpened canes, monocles, capes, Vikings, kings and queens, executioner masks, whores. Now the street was wall to wall. He laid on the horn. The sea of people begrudgingly parted for him. Inching along between 9th and 8th, he saw other storefronts vandalized, and up ahead, the source of the flames. People had pushed a car into the middle of Main and set it on fire. Its windows now littered the pavement, shivers of glass glittering in the firelight, flames licking out of the windshield, the seats and the dashboard melting. Above it all, the traffic signal cycled on obliviously. Ethan shifted into park and killed the engine. The energy on the other side of the windshield was dark and volatile, an evil living thing. He studied all the ruddy faces in the firelight, eyes glassy with whatever bathtub gin had been stockpiled and passed around. The strangest thing was that Pilcher had been right. Clearly, the fate spoke to them, met some deep, consuming need. He glanced into the back of the Bronco and checked his watch. Soon. Wool padding had been stitched into the inside of the headpiece, and it fit him snugly. He reached over and locked the passenger door, although he doubted that would make any difference in the end. Grabbing the stinking cloak and the bullhorn, he opened his door, locked it, and stepped out into the fray. Broken glass crunched under his boots. The smell of liquor spiced the air. He donned the cloak, pushed his way into the crowd. People around him began to clap and cheer. The farther he ventured toward the traffic signal, the louder it grew. Applause, shouts, screams. It was all for him. They were calling his name, slapping his back. Someone thrust a jar into his right hand. He went on. Bodies packed so tightly it was almost warm between them. He finally broke through into the eye of the storm, a circle that couldn't have been more than 30 feet in diameter. He stepped just inside. The sight of them closed his throat with grief. Harold lay on the pavement, struggling to get up, bleeding from several blows to the head. 2 black-clad officers held Kate, the woman he had once loved, each clutching one of her arms to keep her upright. While Harold appeared stunned, Kate was fully present and staring straight at him. She was crying, and he felt the tears sliding down his face before he even registered the emotion. Her mouth was moving. She screamed at him, screamed questions and disbelief, no doubt pleading for her life, but the noise of the crowd drowned her out. Kate wore a shredded nightgown, and she stood in bare feet, shivering, her knees stained with grass and dirt, one of them skinned to the bone, blood running down her shin, and her left eye swelling shut. A scene began to form. She and Harold had gone to bed early, probably still hungover from the night before. The officers burst in. There hadn't even been time to dress. Kate had gone out a window, possibly made a break for the drainage tunnels under town. That's what he would have done. But the 10 officers had her house surrounded. They'd most likely run her down within a block or two. He wanted more than anything in his life to go to her. Take her in his arms, tell her everything would be okay, that she would survive this. But instead he turned his back to her and made his way once more through the crowd. When he reached the Bronco, he climbed up onto the hood and scrambled the rest of the way up the windshield. He stood on the roof, the metal dipping under his weight, but it held. The crowd descended into frenzy again, screaming like their rock star had just walked on stage. Ethan could see everything from where he stood, the firelit faces crammed between the buildings, the burning car, the circle where Kate and Harold waited to die. He didn't see Teresa or Ben, and this gave him some small piece of comfort. He'd warned his wife not to come, had instructed her to take their son, against his will if need be, and ride out the fate from the relative safety of the crypt. He lifted the questionable mason jar of hooch in the air. The crowd reciprocated, hundreds of glass bottles raising, catching the bonfire light of the burning car. A toast in hell. He drank. They all drank. God-awful. He smashed the bottle into the street, drew the Desert Eagle, and fired 3 shots into the sky. It kicked like a motherfucker, and the crowd went crazy. He holstered the pistol and took the bullhorn, which dangled from a strap on his shoulder. Everyone hushed, everyone but Kate. She was screaming his name, screaming, "Why, for God's sake, why are you doing this to me? I trusted you, I loved you, why?" He let her go, let her finish, let her scream it all out of her system. Then he raised the bullhorn. "Welcome to the fate," screams and cheers. Ethan forced himself to smile as he said, "I love it even more from this side of the bullhorn." That got a big laugh. The manual had given specific guidance for how the sheriff should handle this moment when everyone had gathered and the time for the execution was at hand. While a handful of residents may have no issue with killing their neighbors or even relish the job, when it actually comes time for the execution to begin, most people will feel uneasy about spilling blood. This is why your job as leader of the fate is so critical to its overall success. You set the tone of the celebration. You create the mood. Remind them why the guests of honor have been singled out. Remind them that the fate ultimately preserves the safety of wayward pines. Remind them that deviation from the rules is a slippery slope, which could easily result in any one of them landing in the circle next time around. Ethan said, "You all know Kate and Harold Ballinger. Many of you would call them friends. You've broken bread with them. You've laughed and cried with them. And maybe you think that makes tonight a tough pill to swallow." He glanced at his watch. It had been more than 3 hours. "For fuck's sake, any time now. Let me tell you about Kate and Harold. The real Kate and Harold. They hate this town." The crowd erupted in aggressive boos. "They go out at night in secret, and here's the worst of it. They meet with others, others just like them who despise our little slice of paradise." He drummed up some rage. "How could anybody hate this town?" For a moment, the noise was deafening. He waved everyone quiet. "Some of those people, the secret friends of the Ballingers, they're here with us tonight, standing in this very crowd, dressed up and pretending to be just like you." Someone shouted, "No!" But in their hearts, they hate wayward pines. Look around you. There are more of them than you think. But I promise you, we will root them out. It was slight, but as the crowd roared again, Ethan felt the Bronco shift imperceptibly on its shocks. "So the question arises, why do they hate wayward pines? We have everything we need here. Food, water, shelter, safety. We lack for nothing, and still some people feel this isn't enough." Something struck the metal roof under Ethan's boots. "They want more. They want the freedom to leave this town, to speak their minds, to know what their children are being taught in schools." The boos continued, but with a measurable lessening of conviction. "They have the audacity to want to know where they are." The boos stopped altogether. "Why they're here?" The crowd, dead silent, heads cocked and brows beginning to furrow as they sensed the sheriff's speech taking an unexpected turn. "Why they aren't allowed to leave?" Ethan screamed through the bullhorn. "How dare they?" Thinking, "Are you watching this, Pilcher?" The Bronco shook under his feet, and he wondered if the crowd could hear the noise. Ethan said, "Almost 3 weeks ago, on a cold rainy night, I watched from that window." He pointed at the apartment building that fronted Main. "While you people beat to death a woman named Beverly. You would have killed me. God knows you tried. But I escaped, and now I stand up here under the guise of leading this celebration of depravity." Someone shouted, "What are you doing?" Ethan ignored this. He said, "Let me ask you all something. Do you love life in Wayward Pines? Do you love having cameras in your bedrooms? Do you love knowing nothing?" No one in the crowd dared answer. Ethan spotted two officers shoving their way through the people, no doubt coming for him. "Have all of you," Ethan asked, "resigned to Wayward Pines? To life in this town in the dark? Or do some of you still lie in bed at night beside your wife or your husband who you barely even know, wondering why you're here? Dreaming of what lies beyond the fence?" Blank, stunned faces. "Do you want to know what lies beyond the fence?" An officer broke out of the crowd and ran toward the Bronco, machete in hand. Ethan pulled the Desert Eagle, aimed it at his chest, said through the bullhorn, "Fun fact, the shockwave alone from a 50-caliber round will stop your heart." The rear left window of the Bronco exploded, glass showering everyone who had crowded up against the side of the vehicle. Finally. Ethan glanced down, saw a taloned arm sticking through the hole in the window. It disappeared and punched through again. The crowd retreated. A scream that no one could have mistaken for human ripped out from inside the Bronco. Gasps rippled through the crowd. Those closest to the Bronco were clamoring back while those who couldn't see were fighting their way toward the front of the line. The Abbey was going berserk inside, talons shredding the seats as it struggled against the chain Ethan had tied around its neck. He was still aiming the Desert Eagle at the officer, but the man wasn't even watching the gun. He stared instead through the Bronco's windshield at what was trying to get out. Ethan said into the bullhorn, "I want to tell you all a fairy tale. Once upon a time there was a place called Wayward Pines. It was the last town on Earth, and the people who lived there were the last of their kind." Ethan didn't hear the chain jingling anymore. The Abbey had broken free and climbed into the front seat. They had been preserved for 2,000 years in a sort of time capsule. Only they didn't know this. They were kept in the dark, by fear, sometimes by force. They were led to believe they were dead or dreaming. The Abbey was trying to break through the windshield. Some of the residents, like Kate and Harold Ballinger, knew in their hearts that something was very wrong, that none of this was real. Others chose to believe the lie. Like good humans, they adapted, made the best of a fucked-up situation, and tried just to live their lives. But it wasn't a life. It was nothing more than a beautiful prison run by a psychopath. A large chunk of the windshield broke out and hit the hood. Then one day a man woke up in town named Ethan Burke. He didn't know it. The people of Wayward Pines didn't know it. And the sick fuck that built this town sure as hell didn't know it. But he had come to pull the wool away from their eyes. To show them the truth. To give them the chance to live like real human beings again. And that's why I'm standing here right now. So tell me, do you want to know the truth? The Abbey was breathless underneath him, furiously attacking the glass. Or do you want to keep living in the dark? Its head broke through, snarling, livid. Ethan said, "It's 2,000 years later than you think it is, and our species has devolved into the monster that's inside my car." Ethan pointed the pistol at the Abbey's head. It disappeared. There was a long beat of silence. People just staring, jaws dropped, buzzes slayed. It came through the windshield, talons scraping down the metal hood, and crashed into the officer standing at the bumper before he even thought to raise the machete. Ethan put a bead on the back of the Abbey's head and fired. It went limp, the man underneath it screaming and flailing against the weight as two of the cross-dressed men helped drag the Abbey off him. The officer sat up, drenched in gore, his forearms torn up, skin hanging in tatters where he'd tried to protect his face. But he was alive. Ethan said, "Is this too much for you to handle? Want to go back to killing two of your own? Or do you want to walk into the theater with me right now? I know you have questions. Well, I have answers. I'll meet you there in 10 minutes, and I swear to God, if any one of you so much as lays a hand on Kate or Harold, I will shoot you where you stand." Ethan pulled off the headpiece, sloughed off the cloak. He jumped onto the hood, and then stepped down to the street. The crowd parted, giving him a wide, respectful berth. He was still holding the Desert Eagle, and his blood was hot, simmering for a fight. Shoving one of the officers aside, he stepped into the circle. Harold was sitting up in the street in his pajamas, two officers still clutching Kate. Ethan aimed at the one on the right. "Did you not hear what I just said back there?" The man nodded. "Then why the fuck are you still touching her?" They released her. Kate crumpled. Ethan ran to her, knelt down in the street. He took off his parka and wrapped it around her shoulders. She looked up at him, said,
"I thought you had..."
"I know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." There was no other way. Harold was out of it, in another world. Ethan lifted Kate in his arms. He said, "Where are you hurt?"
Just my knee and my eye. I'm okay.
Let's get you fixed up.
After, she said.
After what?
After you tell us everything.
Chapter 24. Ethan led the town into the theater. The Dead Abbey was laid out on stage for everyone to see. Every seat in the house was filled, and there were people in the aisles and sitting on the edge of the stage. Ethan looked down at his family in the front row, but he couldn't get Pilcher out of his mind. What would the man do? Was he sending his men into town right now? Would he come after Ethan, Teresa, and Ben? The town itself? No. The news was out, and in spite of everything, how many times had Ethan heard Pilcher refer to the town as my people? They were still, after everything, his greatest assets. He might retaliate against Ethan, but the residents of Wayward Pines now knew the truth, and that was that. Someone turned on a spotlight. Ethan stepped into the beam. He couldn't see the faces now. Only the harsh blue-fringed light blazed out of the back of the theater. He told them everything. How they had been abducted, suspended, and imprisoned in this town. How the aberrations had come into existence. About Pilcher and his inner circle in the mountain. A few walked out, couldn't stand to hear the truth or didn't believe. But most people stayed. He could feel the mood in the room shift from disbelief to sadness to anger as he described how Pilcher filmed and scrutinized their every private moment. When he told them about the microchips, a woman jumped up and raised her fist, shouted at what she perceived to be a hidden camera in the ceiling.
"Come down here! Are you watching this? Come answer for yourself, you son of a bitch!"
As if in answer, the lights in the theater dimmed. A projector in the back kicked on and cast an image onto the pearlescent movie screen behind Ethan. He turned, stared at the heavy white vinyl as David Pilcher appeared. The man was sitting at his desk in a pose vaguely suggestive of a presidential address, forearms on the surface, hands clasped. A hush fell upon the theater. Pilcher said, "Ethan, would you mind stepping aside, letting me have a word?" Ethan backed out of the limelight. For a moment, Pilcher just stared into whatever camera was filming him. He said finally, "Some of you know me as Dr. Jenkins. My real name is David Pilcher, and I'll keep this short and sweet. All the things your dear sheriff just told you are true. If you think I'm here to explain myself to you, or to apologize, let me disabuse you of that notion. Everything you see, everything I created, this town, this paradise, the technology that made it possible for you to be here, your homes, your beds, the water you drink, the food you eat, the jobs that occupy your time and make you feel like human beings. You draw breath for no other reason than I allow it. Let me show you something." Pilcher was replaced with an aerial view of a vast plain, where a swarm of several hundred abbeys crossed the rolling grasslands. Pilcher's voice filled the theater over the image of the swarm. He said, "I see you have one of these monsters dead on stage. You should all take a good look at it and know that there are millions and millions of them outside the safety of Wayward Pines. This is what a small swarm looks like." Pilcher returned, only now he was holding the camera himself, his face taking up the entire movie screen. "Let's be clear. For the last 14 years, I'm the only god you've known, and it might be in your best interest to keep acting like I still am." A rock hurled out of the darkness and struck the screen. Someone in the crowd shouted, "Fuck you!" Pilcher looked away, watching everything unfold on his wall of monitors. From the wings, Ethan watched as three men climbed up on the stage and began to tear down the screen. Pilcher started to speak, but someone in the back of the hall pulled the projector out of the wall and smashed it into pieces. Pilcher sat alone at his desk. He picked up the bottle of scotch, drained it dry, threw it at the screens. He had to hold on to the desk as he dragged himself onto his feet, swaying. He'd been drunk. Now he was annihilated, staggering away from the desk across the dark hardwood floor. Vincent Van Gogh watched him from the wall, his face shaven, his right ear bandaged. Caught himself from falling on the large table in the center of the room. He stared down through the glass at the architectural miniature of Wayward Pines, tracing his finger across it to the intersection of 8th and Main. His fist went through on the first try and flattened the intricate model of the opera house. His hand caught on the jags of glass as he pulled it out. He punched his bloody fist through another part of the glass, and another. His hand was bleeding profusely by the time he'd broken out all of the glass. The tiny shards and pebbles littered across the town like the wake of a biblical hailstorm. He stumbled alongside the table until he came to Ethan's yellow Victorian. He crushed it, crushed the sheriff's station, crushed the house of Kate and Harold Ballinger. It wasn't nearly enough. He grabbed hold of the table, bent his knees, lifted, and flipped it upside down. Even after Ethan had told them everything, after the movie screen had been pulled down, people stayed in their seats. Nobody would leave. Some sitting catatonic, stunned. Others weeping openly, by themselves, or in small groups, into the shoulders of spouses they'd been forced to marry. The emotion in the room was staggering, like the hushed devastation of a funeral, and in many ways that's exactly what it was. People mourning the loss of their previous lives, all the loved ones they would never see again, all that had been stolen. So much to process, so much to grieve, and so much still to fear. Ethan sat with his family on stage behind the curtain, holding them tightly. Teresa whispered in his ear, "I'm so proud of what you did tonight. If you ever wonder what your best moment was, you just lived it." He kissed her. Ben was crying, said, "The stuff I said to you earlier today on the bench?" "It's okay, son." "I said you weren't my father." "You didn't mean it." "I thought Mr. Pilcher was good. I thought he was God." "It's not your fault. He took advantage of you, of every kid in that school."
"What happens now, Dad?"
"Son, I don't know, but no matter what, from this moment on, our lives are our own again. That's all that matters." People began coming up to see the dead aberration. It wasn't a large one, just 120 pounds. Ethan figured its small size had kept the effect of the trank dart going longer than he'd planned for. It was past midnight, and he was looking out over all the people whose lives he had just immeasurably changed, when he heard the sound of a phone ringing in the lobby. He climbed down off the stage and moved up the aisle, pushing through the doors leading out of the theater. The ringing was coming from the box office. He sat down behind the ticket window, lifted the receiver to his ear.
"How are you doing, Sheriff?"
Pilcher's voice sounded whiskey-thickened and uncharacteristically happy.
"We should meet tomorrow," Ethan said. "Would you like to know what you've done?"
"I'm sorry?" Pilcher spoke more slowly, deliberately.
"Would you like to know what you've done?" "I think I've got a pretty good idea." "Do you know? Well, I'll tell you anyway. You just bought yourself a town."
"I'm afraid I don't know what that means." People were coming out of the theater and gathering around the ticket window.
"You don't know what that means? Means they're yours now, each and every one of them. Congratulations."
"I know what you did to your daughter." On the other end of the line, silence. Ethan said,
What kind of a monster?
She betrayed me. Me and everyone in this mountain. She put the residents of Wayward Pines in danger. She didn't just tell people about the blind spots in town. She created them. Sabotaged everything I...
Your daughter, David.
I gave her every opportunity to...
Your daughter.
It had to be done. Maybe not the way it was done, but... I lost my head. I've been wondering, why have me investigate her murder? Find her body in the road? I assume you orchestrated that. What did you possibly hope to gain? Alyssa never gave up Ballinger Group. I didn't think you'd really investigate your former partner unless you thought she'd actually killed someone. And you should have come to the conclusion it was Kate. You would have if you'd searched her house. I had Alyssa's murder weapon stowed in a toolbox in Kate and Harold's shed. You were supposed to find it, but you never even searched, because I guess you never really thought she did it. Well, doesn't matter now.
How do you sleep at night, David?
Because I know that no matter what I've done, it's all been in the service of creating Wayward Pines, of protecting Wayward Pines, and there's nothing more important. So I sleep just fine. I have a new nickname for you, by the way.
We need to meet, Ethan said. We need to talk about what comes next.
Lightbringer. That's my new nickname for you, translated from the Latin Lucifer. Do you know the mythology of Lucifer? It's quite apt. He was an angel of the Lord, the most beautiful creature of them all. But his beauty? It deluded him. He started to believe that he was as lovely as his maker, that perhaps he should be God. Pilcher, Lucifer led a band of angels in revolt against the Almighty. And I want to ask you a question now. How'd that turn out for them?
You're a sick man. These people deserved their freedom.
I will share with you that it did not turn out well at all. Do you know what God did to them? He cast them out. He created a place called Hell for Lucifer and all his fallen angels.
Ethan said, "And who am I in this fairy tale? Lucifer? And I suppose that makes you God?"
"Very good, Sheriff."
He could hear Pilcher smiling through the telephone.
"And if you're wondering where to go to find this place of everlasting torment that I'm about to create for you, I would say look no further."
"What are you talking about?"
"Hell is coming to you."
A dial tone blared for 2 seconds in Ethan's ear. Then all the lights winked out. Chapter 25. 1040 6th Street, Wayward Pines, 3 years, 7 months ago. On their last day together, she prepared his favorite meal. All afternoon in the kitchen, slicing, stirring, mixing. The simple act of keeping her hands busy somehow carrying her from one moment to the next. But she had to focus, because the second she dropped her guard, it all came crashing down on her. 3 times she'd lost it, crumbling to her knees, her sobs filling the empty house. It had been so hard here, scary and lonely, and ultimately hopeless. But then he'd arrived, like a dream. They'd found comfort in each other, and for a time, everything had been better. She'd actually been happy in this strange little town. The front door opened, closed. She set the knife down on the cutting board, dried her eyes on a dish towel, turned to face him. He stood across from her at the kitchen island, said, "You've been crying."
"Just a little."
"Come here."
She went to him, wrapped her arms around him, and cried into his chest as he ran his fingers through her hair.
"Did you talk to them?"
she asked.
"Yeah." "And?"
"No change."
"It's not fair."
"I know."
"What if you just said, 'I don't have a choice in the matter'?" "Can't you—"
"Don't ask me, please." He lowered his voice and whispered into her ear.
"You know I can't talk about it. You know there are consequences." "It kills me not to understand."
"Look at me." He held her face in his hands and stared down into her eyes. No one had ever loved her like this man.
"We'll get through this."
She nodded.
"How long?" she asked.
"I don't know."
"Is it dangerous?"
"Yes."
"Are you coming back?"
"Of course I am." "Is he upstairs?"
"He's not home from school yet."
"I tried to talk to him about it, but he's going to have a real hard time." He put his hands on her waist, said, "Look, it's done and there's nothing we can do about it, so let's enjoy the time we do have, all right?"
"Okay."
"Should we go upstairs for a little while? I'd like a little something to remember you by."
"I don't want to burn dinner."
"Fuck dinner." She lay in bed in his arms, watching the sky darken through the windows.
"I can't even imagine what it'll be like," she said.
"You're strong. Stronger than you give yourself credit for."
"What if you don't come back to me?"
"Then know this. The time I've spent with you here in this valley, in this house, have been the best of my life. Better than all my time in the world before. I love you, Teresa. Madly and forever, and—" She kissed him and pulled him on top of her. Into her. She was crying again.
"Just be right here," she said. "I love you. God, I love you so much, Adam. Don't leave me. Please don't leave me."
Part 5. Chapter 26. In the last shreds of daylight, Tobias opened his leather-bound journal and read the first page inscription for possibly the 1,000th time. "When you come back, and you will come back, I'm gonna fuck you, soldier, like you just came home from war." He flipped the pages 3/4 of the way through the volume to where he'd last left off. The pencil was down to its last inch. The pipe was getting low. He crushed down the ashes and took a deep draw, collecting his thoughts as the river murmured past. From where he sat, the sun had left the building, although it still struck the summit of the mountain across the river, a half mile above him. That swarm of abbeys appeared to be on the move. He could hear them screeching and screaming as they pushed up on the valley, leaving him a clear path to home. Tobias wrote, "Day 1,308. I'll keep this short and sweet. My last night in the wild and so many emotions. I can see the mountains that surround Wayward Pines from my camp, and with any luck, I'll come out of the cold tomorrow afternoon. There are so many things I'm looking forward to. A warm bed, a warm meal, to speak to another human being again, to sit down with a glass of whiskey and tell people everything I've seen. I alone have the key to what will save us all. I'm literally the one man in the world who can save the world. I carry that knowledge on my shoulders, but none of it really matters. Because the closer I get to Wayward Pines, all I can think about is you. Not a single day has passed when I haven't thought about you, about our time together, about how it felt to hold you that last night. And now, tomorrow, I'll see you again. My sweet, dear angel. Can you feel that I'm close? Don't you know it in your bones somehow that in a matter of hours we'll be together again? I love you, Teresa Burke. Always. Never thought I'd get to write these words, but... This is Adam Tobias Hassler, signing off." Chapter 27. The torched car was still smoking. The traffic light was dark, and the street lamps had gone out. Absent a single light in operation in the entire valley, the stars burned down with a vivid, icy intensity. Ethan walked out into the middle of the street, Teresa clinging to one arm, Kate on the other side of him. If it irked Teresa for the three of them to be so close, she didn't show it. Truth be told, Ethan wasn't sure how he felt walking between them. So much love and passion and pain. Like he was caught between repelling forces, the same poles of two magnets in dangerous proximity. People were beginning to filter out of the theater. Ethan handed Kate the bullhorn, said, "Do me a favor. Keep everybody here. I need to go check on something."
"What's happened?" Teresa asked.
"I'm not entirely sure." He pulled away from her and headed toward the Bronco. The Abbey had wrecked it. There was a large hole in the center of the windshield, and the front seats were covered in glass and eviscerated, foam padding spilling out. He couldn't even see through the windshield, so he climbed up on the hood and stomped out the rest of the glass. He drove south, up Main, wind streaming through the open window frame and his eyes watering against it. When he reached the curve, he veered off the road and followed the tire tracks from his last foray into the forest, high beams shooting through the trees. He found his way back to the dead pine stump and turned off the engine. Stepped out into the dark forest. Something was wrong. And as he approached the fence, he realized it was the silence that unnerved him. It shouldn't be this quiet. Those conductors and studded cable should be humming. He walked west beside the dead fence, began to jog, then run. After 100 yards he came to the gate, a 30-foot hinged section that provided egress from the valley. It was how nomads left, and rarely returned. Pilcher sometimes sent trucks through it into the wild to harvest firewood or obtain short-range reconnaissance. Until this moment, Ethan had never actually experienced the terror of seeing it locked, wide open. As he stood staring through the gate into the unimaginably hostile country beyond, he was gripped with the cold, sinking conclusion that he had misread Pilcher completely. A scream rose up out of the woods, no more than a mile away. Another scream answered, then another, and another. The noise expanding and growing until the ground seemed to tremble with it, as if all of hell was running through the forest, toward the dead fence, the open gate, toward Wayward Pines. For 2 seconds, Ethan stood frozen, a single question looping through his head as the panic and the fear and the terror swelled inside of him. What have you done? And he began to run.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Wayward by Blake Crouch. Copyright 2013 by Blake Crouch. Performed by Paul Michael Garcia. Performance copyright 2013 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.